I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week, Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe announced he was pulling out of the Commonwealth, an organization of 50 member nations, including Britain and most of her former colonies. The move was not a surprise, and nor was it without irony. See, 12 years ago, Robert Mugabe welcomed other leaders in the Commonwealth to Harare, the capital of Zimbabwe, and there they declared their collective faith in democracy, human rights, the rule of law, free speech, and free elections. Well, Zimbabwe was a very different country then, prosperous and hopeful, with a leader who many praised for his ability to lead his nation to a new level of independence. But today, Zimbabwe is in ruins, and Mugabe, many say, is to blame. This hour, a look at the mess that is Zimbabwe and the responsibility borne by its president, Robert Mugabe. How could it happen so fast? How did the people there let him get away with it? Is Zimbabwe an example of a place where other states, whether in Africa or the West, really do need to intervene? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start today with the latest news. To help us with that, we turn to Jason Beaubien. He's NPR's Africa reporter. Jason, nice to have you on the program.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Dick.
Help us with the news earlier this week that Zimbabwe actually chose itself to bolt from the Commonwealth before it was tossed out. Now, to many people here in America, that club of former British colonial nations is a little bit hard to figure out. But it's still a big deal to Mugabe and other African leaders, right?
It is. The Commonwealth holds a fair amount of sway in Africa and throughout much of the rest of the Third World, where the British Empire used to reign. And particularly in Africa, being accepted at the Commonwealth is very important. It was very clear that Mugabe wanted to go to the meeting in Abuja, Nigeria, where the heads of government were meeting over this past weekend. And when he was not invited, it was definitely a slap to him. And then when at the meeting they chose not to lift his suspension, it was considered even more of a slap to him. Excuse me, get rid of that.
I always told you to turn your cell phone off, please.
That's true.
Tell me something, though. You're on the road a lot in Africa.
Yep.
I know you're in many of the countries that are around Zimbabwe and in touch with people in all these different countries. Is there a sense among other African countries that Mugabe's gone too far, that he himself has taken Zimbabwe too far down?
The interesting thing about Mugabe is that there, on the surface, many people who will say that, yes, he's gone too far. And you dig a little bit deeper, however, particularly in poor African countries, and there is still a love for Mugabe. There's a love for the fact that he will thumb his nose at the West, that he'll thumb his nose at Britain. And people can see that Zimbabwe is falling apart. They can see that the economy is in tatters. But they continue to sort of enjoy that there is someone who's a great speaker. He's a fabulous fiery speaker who continues to sort of go by his own rules. And some people still really like him for that.
Last question, Jason. Everybody talks about South Africa's president, Thabo Mbeki, as one man who perhaps has or could have the most influence in persuading Robert Mugabe to alter his policies. But that's a difficult one for Mbeki. He doesn't appear to want to get involved. What's the story there?
Well, probably the biggest loser in this this debacle with Zimbabwe pulling out of the Commonwealth is South African President Thabo Mbeki, because Mbeki has constantly been arguing that we need silent, quiet diplomacy with Zimbabwe, that we need to be going in there. He says his ministers need to be going in there and talking and trying to work out the problems. But over the time that Thabo Mbeki has been attempting to do that, things have gotten worse in Zimbabwe. The repression of the media, the famine that was been going on there. And so at this point, it seems that policy of quiet diplomacy isn't bearing any fruit. And Mugabe, on his own, is now pulling out of the Commonwealth, and it makes it look like Thabo Mbeki's plan has really failed. And it raises the question of what is going to work in terms of a diplomatic way to engage with Mugabe and try to get things to improve in that country where, you know, inflation is over 500%. You know, people are actually starving in that country and are dependent on international food aid. There are petrol queues, gasoline queues, as we say in the States, that go on for days. People park their cars at the gas lines and just leave them there. And this is a country that has been incredibly successful in the past. It's got a good manufacturing base. It's got enough agricultural potential to feed much of southern Africa. And it's completely falling apart at the moment.
Jason, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being with us.
Good to talk to you, Dick, as well.
Jason Beaubien, NPR's Africa reporter. Now, Samantha Power is our guest for the balance of the hour. She's a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She is the author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Her recent essay in this month's Atlantic Monthly is How to Kill a Country, and we'd like to have you in on that conversation as well. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Samantha, welcome back to the studio.
Good to be here.
Now, neither journalists nor human rights reporters, nor writers, nor any of these people are particularly welcome in Zimbabwe these days. How did you manage to get into the country? I thought they were really actively trying to keep folks like you out.
Well, I thought so too, and had one of those petrified flights there where I took all of my phone numbers and my notes and I hid them in pen caps and toiletry containers and so on. And then I got to the airport and there was just a line that said, "Tourists, you know, welcome." So I went straight through the tourist queue and made it into the country with no problem. The issue was really how visible to make yourself in the major cities, because there are certain people in the opposition in Zimbabwe who, of course, are being followed and watched at all times as a way of using them as the kind of magnet to draw out the insidious human rights monitors and journalists who've snuck in. And so I sort of put them on the tail end of my trip where I had traveled the country and felt like I really had a good feel, and then saw kind of opposition officialdom at the end just in case I was going to get thrown out.
Let's just sort of do a little history capsule here. 1980, Mugabe actually takes control of the country. He is praised at that time, as I said earlier in the program, for not turning his or his country's wrath on the white farmers. There is stability. He jumps up the literacy rate in the country. Everybody thinks that Zimbabwe is going to be this leading country in southern Africa. What went wrong?
Oh, you know, the million-dollar question, what went wrong? I mean, I think part of what went wrong is that almost like Tito in Yugoslavia, while we can praise him for the stability that he presided over and certainly now in retrospect given what's happened in Yugoslavia, we can do the same for Mugabe. But if you actually look back, you see how the seeds for destruction are being planted, or rather the seeds for democratic development are not being planted. So he resists the formation of any opposition party, co-opts or eliminates people who are a threat to his power. He gets very accustomed to the wealth, and his cronies get very accustomed to the perks of being a ruling party. I think over time, and this you see this also with Castro, and a few other leaders in history, I suppose, he confuses ruling the country with owning the country. And thus his own preservation of power and ability to cater to his vested interests and the people he feels he needs to stay in power begins to take precedence over the welfare of his people. And he ceases to be with the people. I mean, that's what you see. You know, part of the challenge with so many leaders is how do you keep them connected enough? How do you keep them surrounded with no men instead mm-hmm. of yes men? You know, people who will say, no, that policy isn't actually working. How do you stop, especially when you're the founder? I mean, the danger is all the greater, the kind of cult of your own personality to take hold. And how do you keep out there so that you're actually seeing what the ministers that you've charged with shaping policy are bequeathing to your people? And I think he got more and more removed from the people, more and more desperate. And then some basic economic, probably quite blunderous policies. I mean, you know, he allowed the infrastructure of the country to rot. Money got diverted into such escapades as the war in the Congo, which is quite recent. And he had this thorn in his side for the last 20 years, two thorns, actually. One was that he came to power on the heels of a civil war. There were a whole number of war veterans who he, fought with, or actually he didn't fight, but
they wanted some reward for their part.
They wanted something, and he kind of held them at bay. He really didn't pay any attention to them. He pretty much marginalized them, many of them were really left. I mean, people who were amputees and so on, just left to their own devices, really ignored through the years. And the other thorn in his side, but it nagged at him, and they began to become politically active in the mid-90s. But the other thorn, of course, was the mini Rhodesias that persisted in Zimbabwe. You mentioned, of course, that Mugabe earned plaudits for not turning his wrath on the whites. He didn't do that, but he kept promising that land reform was going to happen. You know, just give me another year, just give me another year. And these white massive commercial farms that accounted for about 70% of the arable farmland in the country up until 2000, that these farms would be broken up into smaller plots, that black farm managers would get their day, get their chance.
I want to talk in greater depth about land reform because it seems so central to understanding what has gone wrong in Zimbabwe. But I want you to use your writer's eye for a minute here and take us to Harare or the surrounding countryside that you visited a few months back. And what did you see there that was such graphic evidence of a country in near ruin? You've spent a lot of time traveling around the world looking at failed states. But physically, what did you see in Zimbabwe that just made you shake your head in despair?
Well, what ended up happening, of course, and I know we're going to talk about the farm issue in a minute, but Mugabe did belatedly, after 20 years, decide to begin seizing farms. He decided this in 2000. And what he did was he handed the farms over not to black farmhands who'd been waiting for their opportunity for their day in the sun or their day behind the tractor, but to his cronies, to the same people that he'd been rewarding over the years and who'd been amassing greater and greater wealth. So, just by the preface to what I saw, if you leave Harare and you drive up the road up north of the capital into what was once known as the Fertile Crescent of the country, the Mazoe Valley, it's called, and it's just the most spectacularly beautiful, sloping hills and incredibly, you can just tell, lush soil, perfect climate conditions for farming. Again, this was the breadbasket, known as the breadbasket of Africa, Zimbabwe was, and this was known as the breadbasket of the breadbasket. Now what you see as you drive up this road are emaciated cows, you know, coming out onto the street because all the barbed wire has been ripped down as squatters now try to, you know, take over little portions
of anything
they can. So yeah. The barbed wire has gone down. These cows, most of them have foot and mouth disease now, apparently. You see yellow stubble of last year's crop, where wheat, you know, winter wheat would now be theoretically being planted. You see tractors that are rusting. You see children at the side of the road with protruded bellies, with distended bellies in the breadbasket of Africa. You see no lushness. You see lush leaves because the climate will give you that, but nothing in the land itself. The farms have not been tilled. And what you see, you know, ultimately in talking to people is that there's no farming. I mean, they're just not farming. So the farming that's going on is a handful of white farmers have stuck to their farms and are farming them by remote control. So they have doled out the responsibility. And then you see little plots that have been put up in the drainage and in the sewers of the major cities where people are just trying to stay alive.
Samantha writes about wheat production in that country down from over 300,000 tons 3 years ago to 27,000 tons today. Remarkable figures, a remarkable story, and we'll get back to it when we come back after the break. We'd like to have you join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My guest this hour, Samantha Power. She has a piece in this month's edition of Atlantic Monthly called How to Kill a Country. It is specifically about her trip to Zimbabwe, what she saw, and her own analysis of the responsibility of President Robert Mugabe for the current condition of that country based on her experience looking at failed states around the country. You might remember that she's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for her book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go straight to the calls here to Raleigh, North Carolina. And Davis, you're on the line.
Yeah, I just had two questions.
Yeah.
And the first one is the land distribution program the genesis of all this chaos? And the second one is the guest entirely opposed to the land redistribution program? And if not, in what way, you know, should it be executed to make it more palatable to the West, who are the ones who seem to be the most opposed to it?
Samantha, I think that, I mean, if I recall what I read in the article, everybody agrees that something needed to be done, something still needs to be done, that there's nobody who's saying no to land redistribution, right?
No, but no, you're right. No, nobody now is saying no to land redistribution, but the caller has a point. How many white farmers would actually have gone along with handing over farms to the government, you know, and how many would have really played if they hadn't known that this was the alternative? I don't know. I mean, they everyone today says we all agree that land redistribution is important. It's just a question of how. Again, I think that some measure of that comes from the fact that their farms have been taken, so now they're right. Anxious for land reform so they can get their farms back. But just to respond to the second part of the question, I think it's I want to stress that it's not the West alone or even primarily that is opposed to the form that this land redistribution has taken, nor is it just the white farmers. Of course, they are the most desperate to get their holdings back. But it is the people of Zimbabwe. I mean, I was so struck, especially given Mugabe's hallowed standing and status as, you know, the father of this country, but how consensual the view was that this was a disaster. I mean, the people who are suffering the most from this are not the white farmers. They've been able to contact their relatives in Britain or move to Australia, sell their tractors in some cases. Sometimes their equipment was seized as well. But they've been able to make do. The people who have been the most devastated by this initiative are the farm workers, more than a million if you include the farm workers and their families. These are the people now that the international community has to feed, the people most capable of feeding themselves, most capable of farming, because what's happened is the people who have taken over the farms, again, mainly Mugabe's cronies, have actually expelled the people who used to work for the white farm workers on the grounds that they were stooges of the whites. So it's really, I mean, the opposition to this initiative comes from within, and yes, it is being echoed from outside and much more in the Western countries than in some of the surrounding African countries.
Let me, for a minute, just go back to Davis here, because when we look back over the past 23, 24 years of that country's history, in your view, if Mugabe had started in a gradual way back in the early 80s, saying, you know, we need to take some of the land and get some of the black Zimbabwean people working that land, could it have worked at that time? Davis, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it might have worked, because as much as I'm biased, you know, in favor of Zimbabwe, mainly because, you know, I'm an African and sometimes you can get a bit, you know, paranoid about things, I still think that he's doing this just to cling on. You know, this is a populist move by and large. This is really a populist move by him. And I wished he had done it earlier and, you know, in a gradual way, like you're saying. I don't know the exact structure of how I would have wanted him to do it, but not in a kind of a last-minute way, you know. It just seems there's something fishy about him suddenly caring and just, you know, getting things into, starting to act now as opposed to having done it from the beginning. So
you're absolutely right, Davis, and there is a major coincidence of timing in this move. It occurred. Mugabe announced the start of what he calls fast track land reform. As you said, it was very rushed, and part of the chaos results in part from you know, this sort of overnight decision and this announcement that everybody should just go grab whatever farm they had if they happened to have a gun and the means to do so. But he made the announcement just after he had been defeated for really the first time electorally in his history. He had put forth a constitutional referendum for the people that he assumed would just be a rubber stamp. It was a way of him holding power longer, centralizing his authority still more. And the people came out. It was the first time that they'd done this. They came out and they said, no, we don't want your constitution. And it was within weeks of that defeat. And he came on television and he was shaking. He was literally, you almost felt sorry for him. It was one of the more poignant scenes. It seemed poignant anyway at the time before what ensued had happened. But he was shaking. He couldn't believe that he had lost the people. And what he did within weeks is he said, okay, you know, I'm taking this as a sign, you know, or as you say, I'm going to use this as a way of rallying people. And basically, let's blame the whites for my unpopularity at this moment. And he thought that this would help turn, I think, his political fortunes around. But unfortunately, because it was done in such a haphazard way, and because it was really the people around him who amassed the farms and not ordinary people, he's actually now, you know, at the absolute nadir of his popularity.
So tell me how it is that he is able to persuade anybody in his country that he can sell this race case for land reform now. I mean, you point out in your piece that Amnesty International has cataloged something like 70,000 incidents of torture and physical abuse by the government. Everybody in the country knows that's going on. Everybody in the country sees the lineups for gasoline that Jason described. They know how dependent they are on UN food. So how is it that they buy whatever it is Mugabe is saying to explain why he's pursuing this policy?
Well, I have to say, they don't. I mean, that is the amazing part of going to this country. Here, they are. Let me add another scene to our image of what this country is like. The highest banknote in the country is 1,000 Zimbabwean dollars. That's and that's worth basically 10 U.S. cents. It doesn't buy a half a loaf of bread. That's the highest banknote. You know, I don't know what our highest banknote is. I've never held one. But imagine if your highest banknote was worth 10 cents and you couldn't buy. So what that means is when ordinary Zimbabweans go into the supermarket and of course, inflation is out the roof. Everything is incredibly expensive. They bring pillowcases filled with, you know, the lower notes. Of course, we all operate in lower notes. Who can get their hands on the highest American banknote? The same is true there. They're carrying pillowcases and suitcases and shoeboxes filled with denominations in order to be able to make purchases. They know how decrepit the state of their country is, and they know who is responsible. In the cities, that has led to a voting of Mugabe's party out of office, again, willing to brave the elements, willing to brave the torture, seeing these armed, you know, party officials at the voting booths and voting the party out of office. Now, all the cities in Zimbabwe are controlled by the opposition. In the presidential election last year, same thing. We all thought, well, people, they're so intimidated and the abuses are just on the rise and there's no independent television or radio which would reach, you know, most people. And there was until very recently an independent newspaper, daily newspaper, but the people will never brave it again, and it clearly doesn't make any difference in their lives. So why would they even show up? Not only did they show up, but they waited outside, you know, sort of like waiting for gasoline. They waited outside for days for the privilege of voting Mugabe out of office.
And when that election was then so badly twisted by Mugabe, and when he basically dismissed everything that the voters had said, why didn't they rise up and toss him out of office?
Well, this is the more frustrating, I suppose, part of the Zimbabwean opposition right now, or at least frustrating to the opposition. There is a peculiar passivity when it comes to rising up. They did their part by voting. That's what people say. So, you know, we will go out and we will vote and we will continue to vote. The intimidation does affect them in that they don't seem to want to go out and protest. I also think I've never been in a country that seemed so in a kind of trance, just almost punch drunk, but also stunned by the turnaround. I mean, they spend most of their day saying, how could this have happened? It was just 3 years ago that the World Food Program had a tiny little office in our country with four people, and their only job was to go out and to get food so that we could feed the rest of Africa. And now 5.5 million of us, half of our population, the highest percentage that's ever been fed by the international community or by the food community, 5.5 million are being fed by the World Food Program. How did that happen over the course of 3 years?
So they are as dazed by the turn of events as...
Completely. And so what you have is you have young people in the opposition who are trying to rally their neighbors and really, really struggling. But keep in mind, one of the reasons for the passivity, in fairness, total fairness, people are trying to figure out how to live and what to do, how to find these banknotes. You know, you go to the bank, they don't even have banknotes to give out to people. And so people who've put their savings, of course, in the bank, you know, the interest rates in the bank are a pittance of the inflation rate, which is 500%. So people's savings are disappearing. They're trying to get out of the country if they can. 70% unemployment. So most people are figuring out, how am I going to feed my children? They don't have time for politics.
I want to get back to our callers. 1-800-423-8255 to Exeter, New Hampshire now. And Hunter, you're with us. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having this program. And Ms. Powers, thank you so much for your book on genocide. My wife uses it in her classes up here at Phillips Exeter Academy. I had the experience in the January of 1980 of going to what was then Salisbury to do the initial investigation for the U.S. Agency for International Development to determine what the nature of our program should be once Zimbabwe became independent. And during that whole time, I was there for about a month and was ordered out the day of the elections, so because we didn't know what was going to happen. And all the people that I interviewed, about 350, only one person said that it was going to be a Mugabe sweep. And interestingly enough, that person was a white South African who was the head of the African and European Chamber of Commerce in Zimbabwe. Everybody else was deluded by whatever they were deluded by, but nobody had plumbed the depths of the local sentiment for Mugabe. Even notwithstanding that comment, at the time that we were putting together our assistance program, we were aware of two major issues that Zimbabwe had to deal with in independence. One was, how do you demobilize the military and get them into doing something productive in the economy? And the second one was, how do you deal with the inequitable land distribution in a fashion that doesn't destroy the enormous agricultural productivity of Zimbabwe? That was 20 years ago, 25 years ago almost. And then we sat there and we watched and we wondered and we kept hoping and crossing our fingers and trying to do what we could.
Was there a point in the past 20 years, Hunter, when you with your own understanding of Zimbabwe went, oh no, this is really not going well? Because there was that sense from among other African leaders, from people in Zimbabwe, from Western observers, you know, he screwed this one up and he screwed that one up. But you know what? It's a strong country. His heart's in the right place. This is going to work. Did something turn for you?
Oh, yes. I think very early on when he brought in the North Koreans to train his Praetorian Guard. Mm-hmm. And the minute that happened, I started going around and talking with my colleagues in AID and the State Department and saying, this is not going well. What can we do to try and ensure that there is going to be some democratic institutions and democratic ability to have a voice in the happenings in the country? And what do we do about the land reform? What do we do about the demobilization of the soldiers? The money was there, but the I guess looking back, I'd have to say that the level of corruption inside the Zimbabwean government, which is excessive even by the standards of many of the African countries I've been in over the past 40 years, it was always, what can I do for myself to line my personal bank account first before anything else?
Samantha, is there a sense there that Zimbabwe is at the bottom, that it's got nowhere to go but up? Or is the strength of the country such that people are still saying, we have to stop what's going wrong now because there's enough here worth saving?
Well, I think both hope and, as I indicated earlier, maybe some of this passivity, but even that is too judgmental a term, distractedness, let's say, with daily life. But hope probably lies in the memory of the standard of living that most people had. I mean, that's where the daze comes from. That's where the shock comes from. Well, wait a minute. How do we go from the standard of living that we enjoyed to growing tomatoes in sewers and to waiting in bank lines for 2 and 3 days, or to sleeping outside on the pavement in the hopes of keeping our place in, so that we might get some of our savings out before it all disappears in terms of worth? But that memory is not a distant memory, as it is in some countries, or in some countries have never had that experience of having that standard of living. So I think there is hope, but unfortunately, a couple things. One, there's a great tendency to be looking now, I think, to Morgan Tsvangirai, who's the head of the opposition, to answer the prayers.
Is he still free, or is he in prison?
He's out on bail, fighting charges of trumped up charges of treason. So this is a sort of good news, bad news. Good news is he's a labor union. He has a real way with the people. He's built this coalition. He was part of the initiative that led to the defeat of Mugabe's constitutional referendum. He really knows how to. He's got white farmers on his side. He's got business owners. He's got farm laborers. He's got
factory workers. But that list you're going through is in fact part of his problem too, isn't it? Because he carries with him every hope of every expectation of somebody who feels like they've been wronged by the Mugabe government.
Yeah, absolutely. That will be the danger, certainly once it comes to governance, and it's a very unwieldy movement, of course. Now, but the bigger worry, I think, is just that people are again looking to the big man, as it were, and Morgan Tsvangirai happens to be a very large man, but they are waiting for him to give them the signal. It is not a movement as, let's say, the ANC was, in South Africa, where you had 1,000 flowers blooming throughout the country. Mm-hmm. There's still a tendency to look up and say, okay, what do we do now, sir? The second worry in terms of the expectations of the people is that there is this tendency to look outside and to say, and Mbeki's got to change his mind. He can't possibly be aligning. You know, Mandela's successor, they all say that. They all say, how could the man that Mandela chose be taking the side of this man who has us in this state? And they look to the West, which a lot of African countries don't. But if you're in this kind of state, you'll look to anyone. And if the only statements of denunciation that you're hearing are those coming out of Britain, despite all of the colonial baggage that Britain carries, you'll take it.
But, I mean, you also make the point, and I'll use this for the ANC example. When the ANC was elected into office in 1994, they took over a functioning system of justice. They took over those organs of sort of a civic society. And it seems in many ways that Mugabe has torn those down to a point where it'll be very hard for anybody to replace him, to actually get them back in order again.
Well, let me give another little sort of seed of hope or glimmer of hope, and that is what another kind of bizarre feature of this despair right now is that everybody is still working through the courts. They're still going to the courts. The white farmers who've been thrown off their land, you know, some of them have been killed.
I thought Mugabe had basically got rid of all the judges who weren't going to pass judgment that favored him. There are still some independent judges in
there
Zimbabwe?
There are a few, but no, you're basically right. And that's what I'm saying. That's what's so extraordinary.
Oh, that people will use that court system anyway.
They'll use it anyway. They are so committed to the idea. Like, everybody has a vested interest in kind of the perpetuation of legalism. Mugabe, because he wants to create the appearance that he's still legalistic and democratic, and the others because they have no place else to go. But there is a commitment to the rule of law in the country that I think can be drawn upon if, in fact, Mugabe is unseated.
1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join this conversation about Zimbabwe at a particularly crucial moment with a reporter and an observer who has come back and written rather eloquently about what the problems in that country are. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, Samantha Power. She is a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School in Government and the author of an article in this month's edition of Atlantic Monthly. It's called How to Kill a Country, and it talks about the responsibility of Robert Mugabe for the remarkable fall from power and wealth of the country of Zimbabwe. We'd like to have you in on the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. So let's go straight back to the calls to Boston. And Edwin, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, please. I'm really disgusted with your guest. From what I'm hearing from her, it seems like she's working with the Western government against President Mugabe. I think President Mugabe is trying to correct the wrong that have been done by to the black people of Zimbabwe. If you look at other parts of the world, first of all, look at Australia, the Aborigine, New Zealand, look at the Maoris, look at America, look at Indians.
Hang on a second here, Edwin. I hear exactly what you're saying, but because every Western country has this hopeless baggage of mistreating its own people, are you saying that that's okay? That makes it okay for Mr. Mugabe to behave the way he's behaving?
I'm not saying Mugabe, first of all, is never mistreated the whites. in Zimbabwe, all he was asking for the fair share of the majority of blacks to get their land back. That's all. Okay, can you tell me, in England, for example, Great Britain, or Europe as a whole, black people going to Western world, owning land, majority of the land, owning most of the fertile land in the center of Europe, can that happen? I can't believe all these people, you know, they're blaming Mugabe. So, their people are
Edwin,
going hungry and they're starving.
Edwin, hello. Edwin, yeah, I need to interrupt here. I need a real quick answer for a question from me, if you can help me. You're saying that Mugabe is doing the right things as a president, and the problems in Zimbabwe are still linked to colonial ownership of the land. Is that correct?
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for that. I want to ask Samantha in on that, because there's a lot to what Edwin is saying, insofar as Mugabe has never taken the army and gone basically through the white farms, shooting the white farmers. You make the point at the beginning of your article that Ian Smith, the former leader of Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, sits in a house in Harare with no gates around it at all. So how do you square this?
Well, I think, first of all, there's also something to what Edwin says, apart from him being disgusted with me, which is disappointing, that the West has seen soiled hands when it comes to these questions. That is, not only have we committed genocide against our own native peoples and so on, but we have backed apartheid regimes, in southern Africa. We did not energetically engage with the land reform issue before the whites were expelled from our farms. We really didn't care about Zimbabwe. This is not a country that we've paid much attention to at all. And we sort of let things go. And then suddenly when the white people, were expelled and were suffering, we began to pay attention. But what I strongly reject in what the caller is saying is this idea that this is a racial issue. The people who are demanding that Mugabe leave office and the people who are complaining and dying because of the decisions he's made, are not whites. As I've said, the whites, as you, Edwin, suggest, are fine. You know, they've got connections, they've got money, they've been living off the hog of this country for a very long time. Most of them, not all of them, are fine. The people who have been destroyed by Mugabe's policies are the Africans. And they are the ones demanding and indeed voting both with their feet, because they're leaving, and at the polls that somebody else take over ownership of this country and then work on the very questions that you're talking about. The solution shouldn't have to come from the West. It can't come from the West. The West is discredited to some extent in these countries. It's surprising the extent to which African leaders are still willing to entertain Western interventions. So I don't think they're fully discredited. The money that Western nations can bring still seems to give them authority in the trade deals and the like. But moral authority, they don't have. And that's why it's essential that African countries get involved and figure out the kind of land reform policy that will actually make Zimbabweans better.
1-800-423-8255. Edwin, thanks for your call. We're going next to Virginia Beach, Virginia. And George, you're with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to share a couple of things. We have relatives in Zimbabwe and South Africa. And in a lot of cases, white people have been there for many generations, you know. They didn't just come.
Your relatives are white. Are they, George?
Yes.
Sorry.
Zimbabwe was just the most, as your speaker knows, the most beautiful, incredible place in the whole South African continent, for that matter. But it's a beautiful place. It has not just been independent for a few years like South Africa. It's been independent for over 20 years. Mugabe's been in power for a long time. It looks like to me, if you're talking about, you know, it's not a black-white thing. It's a everybody starving to death thing. The fact is that the land grabs that they're performing, or going back to the blacks, I don't think anybody wants to argue that point.
But George, let me interrupt here for a minute. The relatives that you have in Zimbabwe, what are they saying? Do they want to stay there with Robert Mugabe as president? Are they staying there because they think he might go soon and they'd get land back? What are they saying?
Oh, no. Most of my relatives are not large landowners. They're working people. But They love, my mother-in-law loves it there. She loves the country. She's been there her whole life.
So what she's saying, is she saying that South Africa needs to come in with soldiers, that the West needs to intervene? What's her solution?
I don't think anybody wants to see that. I think that somewhere, some moral judgment or common sense. The fact is that if you give the land away from the white farmers who've been farming it for, like I say, many generations, the people that are getting the land back, be it whether they should get it back or not, but the people are going to starve to death. It's a simple fact. It's not. I mean, it's not a mystery, and it's not a. It's not a. I mean, it's not hard to figure out. They simply don't know how to deal with that land on a large scale basis. Zimbabwe has just been always able to feed itself. It hasn't been a big importer of food.
George, let me turn, if I can, to Samantha on that point, because I want to go back to something you said earlier in the program, Samantha, about the million or so farm workers who have been displaced in this sort of clumsy land reform over the past 3 years. I get the impression from the time that you spent there that there are many of those people who would do a good job of managing those farms if they'd been allowed to do that.
Certainly, you know, that's what they believe, and that's what that's certainly the impression that one gets. I mean, they're making do with what they can find now. They're trying to feed their families, but what they can't do is feed the country. I mean, you need more land. If you're going to try to feed the country, you need to create commercially viable plots of land.
I don't get this. You've got Mugabe's cabinet ministers who have, one of them's got five farms. Others have two, three farms. Those farms, are they not being worked?
They're not being worked. Now that's the image I'm trying to leave your listeners with. I mean, you just don't see a tractor in motion or a sprinkler that's been turned on in the entire Fertile Crescent of this country. I mean, maybe, you know, one out of, you know, if you drive 20 miles, you'll see one farm that's being operated again, often by remote control, for, you know, by farmers who've been expelled. The country's not producing for itself. It is dependent on humanitarian aid, which from the standpoint of finding African solutions to African problems has got to be the greatest indignity, to have then Britain and America be the ones feeding your people. I mean, that's the ultimate, I think, in travesty and a humiliation for these people.
1-800-423-8255 to Sizikwe now, who's calling in from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Sizikwe.
Hi. It's in relation to the guy, the African guy that came on the line before. I'm from Zimbabwe. And, you know, I'm really sick of the hypocrisy in Africa, where we're always blaming the West for a lot of our problems. You know, I really think Mugabe should go as a black African, and I'm not saying this out of hypocrisy. I think Africa, you know, it's always on the racial line, oh, England did this to us, so the white people. But you know what? Singapore was a British colony. Look at Singapore today, the gross GDP. And I think it's time Africans shed the hypocrisy and we come find real solutions to real problems in Africa.
Sizikwe, I'm going to turn to Samantha in just half a sec, but I want to ask you a question before I do that. And it refers back to something Jason Beaubien said at the beginning of the program, and that is that there is this sort of continent-wide reluctance among Africans to criticize an African leader like Robert Mugabe, that you know, he's seen to be somehow a bigger man for thumbing his nose at the West in a sort of Castro-like way. Is that a part of the problem, that someone like that gets praised simply because he stands up to the former colonial leaders in countries like America?
To be honest with you, sir, a lot of my African friends at the university here in the United States are against Mugabe. And I as a Zimbabwean, I feel so hurt, sir, when I'm in universities in the United States and I look at things in Africa and I say to myself, wait a minute, if Singapore, of all people with no natural resources, can do it, if we mobilize and get serious and start looking at solutions instead of pointing the finger, maybe we can do the same thing. I mean, people are seriously suffering and all Mugabe can come up with is land reform. For crying out loud, I think he should resign and leave.
Well,
and that's why I'm not ashamed to come on the radio as an African and stand up and say, look, this guy's got to go. We got to change our attitudes in Africa and start coming up with real solutions to real problems.
Samantha.
Well, the vast majority of Zimbabwean people would be very grateful for your sort of vocalness on their behalf, I must say. The one thing I would say about what we've seen, let's say, over the weekend at the Commonwealth Summit as an example, is that there are African countries that are starting to part ways, and I think it's the sort of second generation of African leaders that are willing to criticize their neighbors. Kenya, Ghana, Gambia, they all came out and actually argued that that the suspension of Mugabe from the Commonwealth should be maintained until the human rights record was improved. I think Nigerian President Obasanjo, to decide not to invite Mugabe to that summit in the first place was very difficult for him to do when he had Mbeki demanding that Mugabe, and Mugabe demanding that he be allowed to show up. So there are, again, signs that certain people are standing up, but the country that has the most influence on Zimbabwe is South Africa, and there is, as of yet, no sign that Mbeki is willing to change his ways. And unfortunately, the way Mbeki works temperamentally is that the more he has been humiliated, the more he is prone to dig in his heels. He's a bit of a contrarian by nature, and the fact that he's been humiliated now twice in the last week, once by losing the fight at the Commonwealth to have Zimbabwe reinstated, which is what he was pushing for, and then second, Mugabe, while the Commonwealth summit was going on, announced that he was not going to step out of power, that he was going to stay in, that he had no intention of retiring. Mugabe 79, of course, and Mbeki had assured his people and the rest of the world that Mugabe would be out of office by the end of the year. So clearly his quiet diplomacy is not working either. But this will just make him dig in further, I fear.
Sisekwe, just a quick last question to you, because we're right at the end of the program. But when you talk to your friends at university, is there any sense that you and other people with Western educations may have to share the responsibility of what comes next in Africa?
That's what we're looking at. I mean, that's the only way out for Africa. We have the resources, I mean, natural resources, and we just need to get organized and come up with some serious solutions, sir. To be honest with you, sometimes when I look at Africa, it's difficult, but sometimes I see a hope. I'm like, you know what? Let's come up with real solutions. I mean, let's sit down. There's so many educated. This is the largest migrant class of African students, you know, going to the West, going to school. I mean, I see...
Sisekwe, I need to step in here because I'm right at the end of the program, but I want to thank you for your call. And Samantha, if I can ask you in 15 or 20 seconds, are you looking back at Zimbabwe with hope or despair when you sort of sum up your own feeling about your...
Well, I think there's one man standing in the way of the recovery of middle-class African existence and self-sufficiency, and that man is Mugabe. And I think what you could be seeing is a precedent for what could happen in other countries, which is a post-liberation, bottom-up, organic, democratic movement. The hope is that they won't then blanch at opposition when they take power.
Thanks so much for coming in. Samantha Power. Her article in this month's Atlantic Monthly is called How to Kill a Country. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with Jason Beaubien, NPR's Africa correspondent. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.